Well, good morning. That was a particularly invigorating discussion we've just had. In fact, let me commend all the panelists that I've heard speak today. I feel like an honored guest here coming from an ag econ background and totally outside this element, but looking around and seeing a lot of good friends, at, particularly Jerry Nelson and, of course, Leroy Dykeman, whose family I have known for a long time and admire the work that they and others of you have done. And my discussion will actually build, I think, on Patricio's discussion of gaps here, except I'm focusing more from the standpoint of what happens in the human dimension of carrying out those responses to production at the community and the household level. And you see the symbol of the Deaton Institute. I was chancellor for roughly 10 years. I've been away for 2 years, so you don't have to ask me about what's happening in Missouri right now. In doing that, I've also been halftime with the Deaton Institute, which is dedicated to interdisciplinary perspectives, bringing the multidisciplinary work that Heather began. I love that presentation. And I grew up with a lot of dairying in my background, so I was interested in the 65 cow milking herd also. I'd like to follow up on that a little more. But how do multiple disciplines, particularly the strengths of a university, really address the issues of low-income populations of the world and the issue of food security? Because so I'm speaking from the standpoint of that background, as well as my role as chair of the Board on International Food and Agricultural Development, or BIFAD, in which I work with the administrator of USAID to orient our own development policy globally toward addressing these issues. And in that capacity, I work with Rob Bertram, the chief scientist of USAID, who many of you know. He has a plant science background. So I've borrowed a few of his slides as we go along here. Well, if I could get the slide to move. I got it. Thank you. Many estimates of where we're going to be in 2050. You know, for a long time, we have been, the ghost of Malthus has been following us throughout history, or since the late 1700s when Malthus wrote about the population growth ultimately exceeding our capacity to produce food, and we would have global starvation. Here we're at a new turning point, as was emphasized a moment ago. Patricio mentioned that we have 9.8, I believe is the figure he used. I've seen estimates of anywhere from 9 to 11 million people by 2050. And the question is, can we keep up with our food production capability as historically we have been able to do? And we're going to see a little bit about what that means as we seek to really address the needs of the poorest of the poor. The USAID mission, in other words, the citizens of the United States, Europe, Canada, and many parts of the world, including Canada, including China and India today, are dedicated to the proposition of addressing the needs of the poorest of the poor, those who survive on a dollar and a quarter a day or less. And the figure here of 870 million people reflects that chronic poverty. You could go well above that line and still have many, many people in poverty that you'd be deeply concerned about, of course. There's 3.5 million children dying from undernutrition each year. That's a phenomenal figure. And if you want to estimate, I'll leave it to you to estimate how many will die during the time of this presentation or of this hour. It's in the hundreds. And it's really a staggering figure that today we are still seeing a world where these kinds of ills are still before us. And what I have found in looking at the student bodies of our universities for the last decade, particularly, we have seen a tremendous rise in idealism and in dedication to resolving hunger and not allowing these conditions to be pursued. So, in fact, USAID's mission today is to address that. It's the commitment of the Obama administration to eliminate this level of extreme poverty in the world by 2030. And we have been on our way to do that, but we're not going to resolve it or the food production needs of the world by the business as usual that we have seen over the last several decades. And some of this has been talked about already. You're aware of it. The challenge of climate change, water scarcity, the increased use of biofuels, as well as income growth and population growth really challenge what we are doing. With the land issues that we face, the water, the biodiversity threats, Land titling is a serious issue, so you may have a yield gap, as Patricio talked about, and he knows well. So what do you do when the land tenure relationship, the legal rights to that land, do not line up with what you can expect to generate the food that you want to produce? These issues have clouded our responsiveness throughout the history of humankind and will continue to in the usual. But there is continued threat due to both fluctuations in prices on the left-hand side of the screen and the projected changes of real price increases on the right-hand side. Both of these are tremendous threats that face the world and will continue to as we look at the very troubled situation that we are facing as we go forward. And this is on top of the fact that countries like China and India, with billion-plus populations, and the incredible growth in Africa, headed toward over a billion, I think it's around a billion right now, as a continent, the food demand, as incomes increase, is going to drive up the meat protein demand and the amount of grain and crops used to provide feed for the population. It's astounding to think that China today consumes more than half of the world's pork production. I mean, those are the kinds of figures that we're going to be seeing more and more as we see the increases in income. So the left-hand side, very, very troubling, because if you look at the 2007-2008 period, we were dealing with a major financial crisis in this country. The world was dealing with rapid increases and fluctuations in commodity prices because of the many reasons, the real price increase of production, global weather patterns, particularly switches to biofuels to some degree. And these price increases led to over 30 violent changes of government that underpinned the so-called Arab Spring. We are reflecting on that as a nation, as a world. And this is very real. It didn't just happen for the first time here. It's happened throughout history. It just was accentuated during this period. You cannot double and triple food prices unless you can very rapidly double and triple the prices of the wages of all the low-income workers in urban area centers around the world. When that doesn't happen, they cannot feed their families. They go to the streets. This is an almost standard political economic fare at this point. But it's vital that we understand that. The more troubling from a Malthusian standpoint and from an economic cost standpoint, the issue is not so much can we produce the food. The question is at what price will we be able to produce the food, and therefore who can afford to pay for it. The figures on the right simply look at actual real commodity price projected increases in cost. These are real costs, 2010 to 2050, staggering figures really for most of the commodities of the world. I would remind you that the United States and most of the Western world, so-called developed world, have enjoyed their economic growth building on an actual secular decline in food prices over time. So in other words, food has gotten cheaper and cheaper, freeing up more of our income to buy all the other stuff that we do and travel to conferences and so forth. That's going to change when you have the kind of real price increases we see here. So these are sobering kinds of issues. Now, the concern of USAID is the prevalence of undernutrition among the most needy and the extent of that poverty that we talked about a moment ago. And I just wanted to show you that, in fact, how significant it has been that we have had for actually about a 30-year period a steady decline in the proportion of poor people in the world. This is really quite remarkable. And again, as far as we know, the first time in recorded history that we have ever had these kinds of continued reductions of those most in need of help. Much of the data I showed you just a moment ago would suggest that may change as we look to the future. But to deal with such issues as child stunting, which is a critical part of that impoverishment, here the potential, because children not having the brain development as a result of malnutrition and undernutrition simply cannot gain the cognizant capacity to be productive citizens. This is a tremendous drain then on the societies. Instead of producing and going forward from an investment standpoint, the investments are made to look back and clean up the mess that has been created by society, which is all too common of a feature. We do know that agricultural growth and particularly the growth of small-scale agriculture, is the highest return on investment that can be made to alleviate poverty and improve food production worldwide. So this is very, very significant. If you're going to deal with the problem of the poorest people in the world, you've got to deal with the issue of agricultural growth at the small-scale level. And this requires some very specific kinds of attention to issues. And also targeted interventions in nutrition, and the gender issue to ensure that women and children are brought more thoroughly into the economic cycle that's occurring. Else we continue to feed the rich of the world and allow the poor to simply starve to a greater extent. All kinds of calculations have been made about how we can address these issues by linking that sector into the broader growth economy. We obviously have to do it with climate change issues before us in a major way, in a sustainable pattern, and I'm not going to belabor this. You've had some discussion of it here, and you're a group that's more knowledgeable about this than I am, but it's real that we go back and make sure that Brundtland Report of 1987 is examined very carefully and that we exercise economic stewardship, economic viability and environmental stewardship along with social responsibility as we engage these issues. Here today, you've been engaged in the science and technology that's behind global food security. USAID's mission is to leverage that and to do it in a way that draws on the strengths of our university research through the innovation labs that are now at over 60 colleges and university partners with about 24 different labs around the world, combined with the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research. And Patricio, I saw that your work draws heavily, I know, on the work that those centers are doing around the world to enable us to have the body of science before us that leads to the resolution of some of the and taps that potential that is there using science and technology to move forward. So I won't go over. You can just the photosynthetic effects and the that we talked about earlier and the efficiency of water use are some of those issues that you've emphasized here in this session, and they're very fundamental to looking forward globally to small-scale agricultural development as well. And the mission of USAID is to draw on all this science and what you've been talking about here and to find the pattern of intervention that enables small-scale farmers to make a difference so that we can have that biggest impact on the improvement in nutrition of women and children particularly and the economic linkages that drives the economy forward. So that's where we go from the science and technology to the application, and which is the point that I am wanting to emphasize to a principal degree. Certainly, our university knowledge base uses genetic engineering in a variety of ways in addition to the kinds of approaches that have been more traditional, all of which are critical. USAID is exploring all these in their work with the university. Pests and diseases of various types of principal food crops is critical to what we do. And genetic engineering associated with natural resource and fertilizer use efficiency, resilience to climate change, of major staple crops, particularly in Africa, where most of the attention of USAID recently has been as they look at the various areas, geographic areas of the world, where the poorest of the poor are still principally living. The Indo-Gangetic Plain in South Asia, the Sudano-Sahelian system in West Africa, the maize mixed systems in East and Southern Africa, the Ethiopia highlands. Three research themes have developed from what USAID has examined, and the productivity frontier, or the sustainable intensification, is really what has come out of that, so that we can transform production systems and improve nutrition and food safety and food quality, and particularly of women and children around the world. So there's a variety of specific techniques one can use to look at sustainable intensification and to apply it, but it requires a multidisciplinary approach that looks at the whole farm issue and household decision making as it affects that, so that you can gain the productivity from the variety of small scale capital formation effects, the prudent use of inputs, and the socioeconomic, nutritional, gender, and cultural conditions, all of which are so critical to addressing those issues. For example, with sustainable intensification, the issue is, given a certain amount of nitrogen application, how do you get relatively more food from it through more effective application? Or can you apply, in other words, get more food with the same amount, or use the same amount of nitrogen and get more food from that, or by producing more of injecting more nitrogen, you get a relatively greater impact on the nutritional on the production of crops. This is something very germane to what you're doing, and estimates have shown, in fact, that there's great potential here in so many areas to more sustainably address these issues. I'm going to just summarize here pretty quickly as we go forward, because it's the transformation of the smallholder that I've been trying to emphasize. USAID is emphasizing women and gender differences because, in fact, data has shown that if women had equal access to agricultural inputs that men have, with the access to extension systems and land titling rights, we would eliminate 140 million of the poorest of the poor in the world today. Because women are far more efficient in what they do, they're much more committed to ensuring that the food feeds children. I've been involved in research that demonstrates that very, very clearly. If you take a comparison of cash equivalent or food equivalent with the women in control of the food, you get about a 30%+ increase in caloric and nutritional intake for the families. Study after study has demonstrated this. So we can't just go ahead biologically and systematically without ensuring that we have the kind of social transformation that is needed. I know I'm running out of time here, and I do want a lot of time for discussion. I just wanted to point out that the examples are a woman like Rhoda Minganye in Malawi, who supports seven people on about a half a hectare using crops and then adding livestock, pigs and goats, into her operation. This is the scale that many families in the world are addressing. I've already touched on these principles. I point these out because in my work with non-governmental organizations that collaborate and actually implement so much of what USAID does, at the household level, you can do a great deal to improve the ability of small-scale farmers, if this hands-on approach, to increase the production and to make food available, always drawing on the frontier of scientific technology and ensuring that that's in play at all times, and developing kind of appropriate financial mechanisms that Grameen Bank, among others, has highlighted in their work. And then we have the potential of affecting the children of the world. Thank you very much.
Well, wonderful, wonderful. We don't have enough room with two chairs to bring the whole panel up here, but we have 20 minutes reserved for discussion. So, I would invite you to look in your book here, and I'm going to read the authors real quick, and just so then you're just refreshed. Of course, we had Dr. Dykman, Leroy Dykman, on the concept of the solar corridor, physiological perspectives with Harold Reitz, and Mara Vanhill with skip row planting and soil biology with Robert Kramer. Jerry Hatfield, radiation use efficiency, light, water, and temperature with Dennis Timlin, and diverse dairy cropping systems with Heather Karsten. And then, of course, we just had Patricio Grassini with the yield gaps, and now global food security with Brady. So any discussions with and any questions for any of the speakers or anyone in the audience want to make a statement about what they've heard today or how, I don't know, I got all kinds of integrated thoughts in my head.
I wanted to ask Heather about did all the machines run on SDO?
No, not all of them. We assume that some of those operations would be custom operations, like custom combining, and actually the manure hauling would usually be custom done at that scale of farming. So we grew enough canola to run the tractor pooled operations that would be, you know, owned the tractor operations that the farm would do. Or that was our goal. Most years almost every year we grew enough for that SDO tractor.
How much canola did it take to to supply how many gallons of diesel?
So I don't remember all the numbers exactly, but we were able to grow sufficient numbers when we, especially when we had 40 acres, although we dropped it down to a lower acreage of canola, but on a 240-acre farm, if we had the 40 acres, we had more than enough. We actually decided how much acreage to use to have enough meal in the dairy ration for protein. So we determined it more on the dairy ration. But that's very low cost. It's a byproduct of the canola industry, and so it was okay to drop the acreage of canola.
That's just really interesting. The farmers in our area were curious about that. You know, what's the, and for us, it's like 1 acre to 16 acres of production. 1 acre of canola could produce enough SBO to farm 16 acres of canola.
Interesting number. Other thoughts and questions?
Yeah, I just, the last speaker was speaking about smallholder, the opportunity in the smallholder agriculture. Well, that's what the session this afternoon is going to be on, to try to fit the smallholder. I sure enjoyed the presentation we had this morning. It's been great.
Yeah, the smallholder session will be in this room starting at 1:30, or 1:05 rather, starting at 1 o'clock, 1:05, with the business meeting for the Solar Corridor community right after that. So,
just a question generally to the Solar Corridor guys. I'm surprised how much variety and selection played a big deal in this. And my question is, if you sat down as a panel, could you design the right variety with the right characteristics that would optimize the solar corridor potential? I mean, it's not picking up, it's not talking to the salesman and picking something off the list, but what are the characteristics?
I don't know what, you know, but I know the characteristics. If we could have the hybrids that have the highest, largest capacity reproductive sink to pull, okay, and then, but in order to, for that to be relevant, you need to have a very productive source. Okay, so I'm looking for hybrids that have the greatest reproductive sink and know that also have the duration of the chloroplast productivity. Duration of chloroplast productivity. Those two components, I would think would be what I'm looking for.
If we were to follow on to that, the question that I had listening to some of the discussion was there was at least inference that because the lower leaves were so productive, it was putting more carbohydrates down in the roots. It seems like if you're going to load up a single plant, either with two ears or a larger ear, you're going to have to look at something that maintains that root system and the integrity of the lower part of the plant.
Well, that's why I was thinking for the second component, those that do have a larger duration. You know, it looks to me like there's kind of a bell-shaped curve on how the aggregate productivity of the chloroplast during the life of the plant, and if we can extend that out further to the right.
But is that a function maybe that the lower leaves are active longer? That's part of that's going to the roots and not solely up to to the ear.
It looks to me like the source can outproduce the reproductive thing. But see, the one hybrid I had that went flat, would always go flat in the field. But when you got light of lower leaves, it stood straight. So that I think. And then with the root work that Bob is doing on the carbon, that there we might see some things there.
I think it's true in other hybrids as well. So just awesome.
Well, a lot of people spend an awful lot of effort to try to develop a hybrid that's different. You know, and it's understandable that there would be some differences there.
Yes, I was so impressed with some of the research that if you integrate it within a holistic research regime around the solar corridor concept as a flexible farming system, and you took a look at the other two main considerations in growth cycles of all the different variety of crops. But within this new framework, you might get a very different agriculture net in the developed world as well as the underdeveloped world, which has been my focus. What occurred to me when I joined the Solar Corridor and joined ASA for the first time a year ago was that it wasn't about solar panels and using solar panels for drip irrigation, which is what I thought I was joining. And what occurred to me when I heard about the morphology and the structure of the plant itself in terms of the genetic manipulation regime for research, we could take a look at the optimal plant characteristics and actually breed those, because we have that entire science, and then take a look at all other of the two aspects, the water inputs in the various varieties and the crises of water, but also the opportunities of new forms and really efficient forms of irrigation. So the whole water delivery thing and all the nutrients, but within a new framework, because the sun is the other of the three components. You got sun, water, and nutrients. And if we looked at all of the others within the context of sun, you might get a different agriculture and an output, and sustainable output. So anyway, I think that's a whole new area of research focus that is really important just for all aspects of developed world agriculture as much as the underdeveloped world. I just see this as a huge opportunity for research.
Yeah. I think you're right. He's very right. Back in the back. You, ma'am.
I have a question for Dr. The goal too is to get to small full deployments, especially women. For anyone who's lived and worked in Africa, I know that, I mean, that's true. But how do you get to them, right? I mean, I'm assuming most of us in this room don't work for NGOs, and that's really how you usually get to them. So, what would be your advice for us who are based here? Like, how can we help do this? Because now that I'm no longer there, it is something harder.
Thank you. And let me say, the USAID's work is with NGOs broadly. And I mean, the Solar Corridor concept is exciting for me because of the question asked just a moment ago, the linkage of so many of our systems of research. Root research is a big thing, and water savings and massive changes in irrigation systems in China right now. As you may know, the University of Missouri is very involved in that. So they're working with universities, engineering firms to address massive global water issues. I recently gave a workshop at the ADRA, the Dennis Development Relief Agency, because they have hundreds of workers worldwide that are working with USAID, with faith-based groups, to implement these practices at the farm level. And students increasingly are on a voluntary basis. There's a coalition of universities nationally called Universities Fighting World Hunger, UFWH. And I have a brochure. I only brought one for my notes here, but February 26th, 27th, I'll say, at the University of Missouri, it's going to be the 11th annual event, which simply says university students and universities are committed to making all these disciplines available to address the issues of the poorest of the poor. And the way you get to them is by universities recognizing the power of this knowledge base we have, and ensuring that it gets extended to those who need it. And whatever avenues of indigenous extension systems, church or faith-based groups, or voluntary efforts, Peace Corps is very involved in this worldwide right now, along with USAID and other donor agencies of various countries. So there's multiple strategies that go right down to the household level. And you can't assume anything. Our recent research looked at household decision-making in KwaZulu-Natal in southern Africa. All of the low-income farmers had absolutely no knowledge of the availability of a wide variety of productive seeds. You say, well, how can that be? Well, you have to know how the culture is operating to answer that. But if you don't answer it, you're not going to solve these problems that we're all committed to trying to solve. So it's an engineering kind of social engineering, institutional engineering framework. You can extend that to looking at land titling and so forth, and as well as gender roles in training programs. So I didn't have a long answer, but you found something great for you there.
I appreciate looking at that issue about stormwater management a few years ago when we were generating research publication on advancing the ocean for example. And as I listened to you, and I was very inspired by some of the things, it seems like we've got three issues that we're really looking at. You're looking at yield gaps, in other words, potential yield of where we are now. And I would have to echo what Brady said relative to the technology gap. That's a different thing than the yield gap. And how that information, even where the current production is, can be better translated to the people that can use it. This is a very frustrating thing to me, as I've pushed along a lot of things in terms of research. But where is it going? And you can raise that question, and if you've got 5 years left in your professional career, are you better off looking at potentials up here or looking at that gap where you try to get the information we have now also those people? I'm going back, I've involved this recently on a project in Ghana where they're trying to redirect their extension program and it's bimodal to look at those farmers that have real high degrees of land area and productive capacity, but not forgetting, and particularly in the northern part where desertification and things are causing tremendous stress, how you reach those people. Now, we think of cell phones and all the different things that are going on. There's lots of ways to reach them, but we don't necessarily always package the information together. It was interesting to look at the paper about the water and its inner role and on the role, and how you translate that into something that that woman, whoever she is, can understand how that works and uses it. That's the challenge that I see coming along in our educational program. How do we get that information to those people? It may be, in a short term, a much better strategy than generating more information that in 25 years, of course, is going to be available. But we've got to get that information to them now. That's the key thing that they need to find.
It's grand challenges, here and then here.
Okay. Mine is bringing you back a little bit, maybe, to North America and less so from the international perspective, but on the question of the, you know, how would you, what characteristics would you look for in terms of, say, maize in one of these systems? I'll take a little different tack. What would you want to see in terms of the floor crop? And I would challenge or propose to this group maybe to look at things a little bit differently. In some of the areas around the globe where you can have a lot of hand labor to look at harvesting different systems. In North America, and I think other parts of the developed world, you need to look at something that fits a mechanized system. I would propose to this group, if it's even within the realm of possibility, of something that would be considered a living mulch. The idea of something that you turn off at the time that you want the maize to grow, and then turn back on at the end of the season. To me, being very limited, I think in terms of things like something like a growth regulator that holds its suspended animation, but there may be many different approaches to that. I think because of food safety issues and other things, intercropping in North America are going to be very, very difficult, but very worthwhile elsewhere in the world. So, again, I throw that out. I also think, to one of the points that was made earlier, for harvesting mechanically, wheat, say, between the rows, something that looks more like a cotton picker with two rows, three rows, wheat capability or corn capability is, you know, feasible. The other thing that came to mind in some of the discussions, can you plant a small grain earlier with a shorter season of corn that you could then, like an oats, I know that a former employee of General Mills said that they'd like to increase human consumption of oats in the U.S. So something that could be planted early spring and then out by the time corn starts getting, So those were just ideas thrown to the panel.
Let me go over here, then we'll go there, then we're going to have to stop. No? Okay, we'll go there.
One of the things that I didn't mention as I was putting this talk together, I was talking to some people in the machinery and technology area that there were some limitations on equipment. They said, don't worry about it because where we're going in many cases with robotics might be going to smaller sized equipment that would very well fit into this. And in the international market as well.
Yeah, if we can prove this to be a viable system, then the equipment will be developed to meet the system needs, I suspect. Was there one over here? Don't tell the engineers that. Very quickly, and then I'm going to dismiss everyone for lunch.
Very quickly, I would just emphasize that we have to develop, enable other countries to strengthen their capacity for their own educational system. And that's critical. We're pressing the external group appointed by the President to advise USAID. We're pressing USAID to move more aggressively in that area. So we can't do it, but we can empower them with the knowledge to do it.
I want to thank all the speakers and thank the audience for their great attention and intriguing discussion.